All right, so this is James Newberry, and I'm here with Mr. Larry Thompson on March 9th, 2020, at his hangar at the Cobb County International Airport. I want to thank you for sitting down with me, Mr. Thompson. Do you agree to this interview?
Yeah, I do. It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much. So could you tell me your full name?
Larry Brantley Thompson.
And what's your birth date?
December 11, 1942.
Where were you born?
I was born in Jasper, Georgia, and moved to Cobb County with my family when I was 2 years old.
What part of Cobb County did you live in?
I lived in the west part in the Fair Oaks District.
Okay. And you mentioned that that was close to Dobbins.
Yes, it's right at the western end of the Dobbins runway.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about how that proximity sort of...
Well, as a young boy, we were all, you know, it was an aviation community, and all of us young boys were just enthralled with airplanes because they're flying over us all the time. Back then, it was World War II airplanes predominantly, P-51 Mustangs, Catalina, PBY Catalinas, or banana boats, they called them back then, B-25s, B-17s, B-24 Liberators, a few jets, the B-47, they were putting together over at Lockheed and assembling it, so we saw quite a bit of that back then. But as young boys, we'd all name them, and we'd get into arguments. That's a P-51. No, that's a P-40. No, it's a P-51. And almost get in a fight over it, you know, as young boys. And then we started building model airplanes when I was in the first grade. And just an airplane enthusiast. It's been a passion my whole life. And that's kind of how I got started at it. And I started taking flying lessons when I was 12 years old. And soloed my 16th birthday. Got my private license my 17th birthday. And my commercial on my 18th birthday. And my flight instructor's rating then. And I flew professionally for years. And then... I was going to school down at Georgia Tech, and if it hadn't been for this airport, I wouldn't have been able to go to college. But I made enough money to pay for tuition back then. It was $150 a quarter. Tech was on a quarter system back then. And I could always get the money up for school, but aeronautical engineering books were expensive. I can remember one book, A Principle of Aerodynamics, was $250. And that was a lot of money back then, but you could use it for several years because you were involved in it all the way through. Well, here at the airport, they had a jug over on the counter where I worked that said, they called me Tiger, and it said, Tiger's Tuition and Book Fund. And all the guys would put their chains in there, and every quarter, the pilots that flew around here would come to me and say, have you got the money for your books this quarter? If I didn't, they'd all pony it up. So I couldn't have gone to college had it not been for this airport. Simply, purely without any equivocation, I say that. I couldn't have gone. And then two, there was a fox den off the end of the runway, and George Montgomery, that owned the Coca-Cola bottling plant, had a little small airplane here. And he had what was called Rockridge Rod and Gun Club. It was a place where you could pay and go hunt pheasants or whatever you wanted to. Well, they would have a fox hunt on Sunday afternoon, and I would trap a fox down here. There was a den down here, and I would put, I'd use leg traps, but I'd wrap it with foam rubber and tape so it wouldn't hurt the fox. And then I would take it over there. They'd give me $50 for the fox for the hunt on Sunday afternoon, and it was really hilarious. People would be all dressed in their fox hunt paraphernalia on horses, and they'd have all these dogs out there. Well, I would turn the fox loose. The dogs would go nuts, buck all the people off the horses, and then they'd just go drink the rest of the afternoon. And by the time I'd get back to the airport, old fox was back over here, you know.
Unharmed.
Unharmed. And it got to where we had a partnership going. You know, it got to where I could pet it and everything, you know. And I'd put a cage down there with a piece of chicken in it with no trap or anything, and come over here, and he'd be sitting in the cage, you know, and I'd pick him up and take him over there and turn him loose. But they'd pay me $50, and back then it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it could keep me in school, you know. And then I started flying when I got my license. And back then it was a lot different than it is now. The fellow I worked for had a shuttle service back and forth to Hartsville. And I'd fly down there sometimes three or four times a day, taking people down there to catch, you know, airlines. And back then, I could just taxi right up in the gate area, and they knew what gate they were leaving out of, so I'd just taxi in there and let them out, and that'd go up the steps to the gate and get on the airplane wherever they were going. And a lot of times, I'd take two or three people down there and pick up two or three people and bring them back. Well, my boss paid me $5 for every trip I took. And so sometimes I'd make three or four trips a day, and a lot of money back then, you know,
yeah,
doing that. And then this time of year in the springtime, the peach orchards down in South Georgia, a lot of times you'll get a late freeze and it damages that peach crop. Well, to keep that frost from settling on those peaches, if you keep the air stirred up around those peach orchards, it won't kill that peach crop. And so they would pay $200 an hour for somebody to fly real low, right, all over those peach orchards at night, and they would put smudge pots all the way around them. And it was very dangerous. That's why they paid so much. But I made a lot of money doing that back then. And all that was so I could stay in school. But what happened to me, I got a job flying for United Airlines first quarter of my senior year. And so I dropped out of school to take that job, and I'd signed up for school, and I had a class date with United out in Denver. And I had everything timed to where I could get my class date and go through their program and get a route assignment before the draft board caught up with me. But it was an airline pilot was a draft deferred occupation at that time because critical occupation. And if you're an airline pilot, you're exempt from the draft. But you had to be a line pilot. You couldn't be a pilot in training. So I get to Denver after I dropped out of school. I figured the draft board would take that long to catch up with me. So I got to Denver, and they delayed my class date by 2 weeks. And I like 2 weeks having a route assignment with United when I got my draft notice.
Oh.
And then I was drafted into the military.
What year was that?
That was 1965.
Okay.
And when I got to basic training, they give you all kind of tests, you know. First, when I went into the military, they gave me a test purely about flying. And after I'd taken the test, the guy called me in and he said, what did you do in civilian life? I said, well, I was a flight instructor and I was going to school. And he said, well, nobody's ever matched this test, ever. And he said, we're needing flight instructors. So they wanted to give me a warrant officer commission and send me down to Fort Rucker to flight instruct for 4 years. But I'd had enough of that. I'd had about 4,000 hours of flight instruction at that time. So I turned it down. And I said, I just want to serve my 2 years and get out and go to United. So when I got to basic training down in Fort Benning, this drill instructor called my name out one morning. They're meaner than hell. I mean, those drill instructors are mean as they can be. But he called my name out one morning and told me to report to the mess hall. So I went over there, and this colonel was sitting there, and I'll never forget it. They had orange juice, ice cream, and coffee, and cookies. You don't get that in basic training. I mean, meat and potatoes is all you get to eat in basic training. So anyhow, this colonel said, you qualified for officer's candidate school, and I've got the paperwork here for you to sign. And I said, well, what do I have to do? And he said, well, you've got to serve 4 years and all this kind of stuff once you get your commission. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. And he said, well, strictly voluntary. You don't have to. And I said, well, I'd rather just serve my 2 years and get out. And so he turned around to this sergeant and he said, Sergeant Vernon, will you take over? And so this sergeant gets on a bicycle and said, come with me, Private. They ran me out to the rifle range 12 miles away, ran me back. As soon as I got back, I went to the mess hall and started peeling potatoes. And then after the morning meal, I washed pots and pans and it was back out to the rifle range and back. And then I started peeling potatoes for lunch. And then after lunch, I washed pots and pans. Then it was back out to the rifle range and back. Then I went for the evening meal, went back to peel potatoes and wash pots and pans. I lasted 2 days doing that. And I finally told that sergeant, I said, you know, I've decided that officer candidate school is a pretty good deal. I think I might want to take it. So the next morning, they brought the cookies and ice cream and all this stuff down, and I told them I'd agree to it. And so I signed the paperwork. Then I went to the formation the next morning, and this drilling sergeant gets up, and he said, I want you privates to know that one day Private Thompson's going to be my boss, but today his ass is mine. So, I mean, I got a frying pan into the fire. But I took a commission, and I had orders for flight school, but I didn't want to take it because helicopters, and I don't like to fly them. And I was offered an inter-service transfer into the Marine Corps. I could have went to Marine Corps flight training because you only had to have 2 years of college at the time, and I didn't finish my degree when I dropped out. But I decided not to do that and go ahead and go to officer candidate school. I graduated top in my class and was assigned to an 85th warhead detachment where my only function was to maintain warheads. I was trained as a nuclear weapons tactics and deployment expert. And then I was trained in the arming devices for all nuclear warheads and stuff. I was frozen in country and frozen in MOS. And then when my time was up, I was a first lieutenant at the time, but I was offered a promotion straight to field grade, straight to major with a $60,000 reenlistment bonus. That was a lot of money in 1969. But I knew that weapon system inside out, upside down, backwards, and forwards. And in fact, it was manufactured by the Martin Orlando Corporation at the time. And some of their tech reps would come to me with problems they had with the system because I knew it inside and out. And it was kind of like flying. I mean, when you count a missile down, it's like doing a pre-flight inspection on an airplane. You're checking all the circuitry and all that kind of stuff. So I really enjoyed it. I almost stayed And if I'd known what they were doing at the time, I would have stayed, because I'd have wound up with at least one star and maybe two, but I'd have been frozen in nuclear weapons. And, right. and I just didn't want to push a button at some point in my life knowing I'd kill a million people. So I decided I didn't want any part of that. So I got out. And then, but back to flying, I got off on a tangent then. But back to flying, it started when I was, you know, just a very young boy, first, second grade, and I would do anything to get in the air. I'll tell you some things I shouldn't be telling, but it's okay now, I guess. There was a guy down at that little airport on Austell Road, a guy named B.T. Smith, who worked at Lockheed, and he owned an airplane. And he couldn't get a medical certificate, but he loved airplanes. And so I got to where I would sneak and fly his airplane and go to jail for that. Now, it was a different time then. So anyhow, B.T. walks up one day, and he said, "Larry, I really don't mind you flying my airplane, but quit putting that car gas in there. It's burning the valves." So I got to where I knew him very well, and on Sundays, he'd want to go someplace every Sunday, so we'd go to fly-in breakfast or whatever, you know, he loved to do. And unfortunately, he passed away when I was in the military, but I've often thought about that.
But you mentioned his airplane. Where was he keeping it?
Down at that little dirt airfield on Austell Road.
So when you snuck in there to fly it, I mean, how did that go? Imagine from somebody who would never be able to do such a thing.
Well, back then, you didn't have keys in airplanes. You turn the switch on, start it. They didn't have starters. You'd prop them, you know, with your hands.
Okay.
And there's no fencing around that airport. It's a little dirt strip. It's only 1,600 feet long. And it had a drainage wash across the middle of the runway. And on takeoff, you had to get going fast enough to pull your airplane up off the ground and get over that little ditch, then finish your takeoff run. Mm-hmm. And then on landing, you had to land and get stopped before you got to the ditch, because it'd flip your airplane over if you didn't. And that's what first airplane I bought, that's what happened to it. The guy that landed there didn't know about the ditch and tried to stop it and ground looped the airplane, tore it up. And
tell me about that plane.
It was a Luscombe, a little single-engine, two-passenger airplane. And when he wrecked it, I walked up to him, and I said, I wasn't but 14, 15 years old, and I said, "I'll give you $500 for it." And he looked at the airplane, he looked at me, and he said, "Son, you just bought yourself an airplane." And I said, "Well, I need 90 days to get the money up." So I sold my horse, my bicycle, everything I owned in the world. I go down the road picking up Coca-Cola bottles to go sell them, anything I could do to get money. Finally got the money up to buy it. And a couple of guys that worked at Lockheed helped me rebuild it. And so I flew that all over the country. The summer between my junior and senior year, my parents let me take it, and I flew all over the South, you know. And I'd worked for a couple of weeks to get money to keep going and all that kind of stuff. But when I started back, I ran out of money. So I started selling instruments out of it to get the money to get home on. And when I got home, all I had left was a compass and an oil pressure gauge. And I figured I had to have those two. And so I got home that way. But back then, it was a different world. I could land that airplane in the road at night, and I'd just sleep under the wing. And I'd have a lot of police would come by and say, "Are you okay? You hurt?" And I said, "No, I'm just spending the night here." And then, so that's okay, we'll check on you, you know. And then I've had some of them take me down to his local service station to buy 5 gallons of gas to put in that airplane and a patrol car, you know.
Is there a radio in a plane like that? I mean, or you just flying completely
just
on
flying,
your own?
Just flying. There's no radio in them. In fact, I have landed at Hartsville with no radio and back in the day, and they had light signals. You just go into the traffic pattern, and you look at the tower, and they give you a green light, which is okay to land, or they give you a white light. I can't remember now what they meant, but a white light meant to circle, you know, until you got the green light. A red light meant go away. And so, but I've landed down there many times without a radio.
That's incredible. Before we go on, there were a couple more questions.
Oh, I'm sorry, I got off on a tangent.
No, please, I love it. I just want to make sure I get a couple basics out of the way. So tell me your parents' names.
It was my mother's name was Virginia Lee Thompson, and my dad's name was Levy B. Thompson.
And how do you spell Levy?
L-E-V-Y.
Okay, and what did they do for a living?
My dad, my mother was just a housewife. She didn't work. My dad was a salesman for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. Now, back in the day, every kid's parents worked for Lockheed. And the question wasn't, where does your dad work? The question was, which department does your dad work in? Because everybody worked for Lockheed. Lockheed employed like 35,000 people back then. Mm-hmm. But my dad was one of the few who did not work for Lockheed. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I started building an airplane, built my first airplane. I built three in my lifetime. But I started building that one. And I ran out of money, I had the wing built and the tail section built, and I ran out of money, so I used for the fuselage just a 4x4 post, and I cut a hole in the wing so I could stand up in the wing and had the controls out here. First hang glider, I guess. And my buddy, his father had a pickup truck, so we snuck the pickup truck out one day and went up to Kennesaw Mountain, and I stood in the back of that truck while he came down the road, and there's one place up there, it's a sheer cliff. Well, the airplane was developing lift, I could tell, so when we got going toward that curve where that cliff is, I told him to speed up, and I just jumped out of the truck over that cliff. Well, when I put that 4x4 in there, I didn't recalculate the center of gravity on that airplane, and when the 4x4 changed all of the calculations I'd done, so it was tail heavy, and it'd go down, it'd climb, it'd stall, it'd climb, it'd stall going down a hill, and I finally went into a bunch of little small pine trees. And when I did, they broke off little limbs, stuck all in me. So my buddy took me to the hospital, and my dad came in there, and he took one look at me, and my mother was there, and he said, "Jenny, you have raised a fool." And he turned around and walked out.
I have to ask what your parents thought of you as this, little engineering kid.
Well, my dad, I started working in a grocery store to get the money to take flying lessons when I was young. I worked in Matthew's Supermarket. And I'd work 60 hours a week for 40 cents an hour and got $24. And flying lessons back then were $12 an hour. So I'd go down on Sunday afternoon and spend all $24 taking flying lessons. And my dad thought it was just some kind of a carnival ride. He thought I was just wasting all my money doing that. But my mother could see the importance of it. And so she was right. It was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, learning to fly. But she would always back me up. But he wouldn't take me. By then, I'd started taking flying lessons down at Fulton County Airport. And I'd ride my bicycle down there. I lived on Austell Road. It'd take me 2.5 hours to ride the bicycle down there to take flying lessons. It'd take all day Sunday afternoon to get all that done. You know, I'd spend all my money down there. But it's just been a passion. I mean, it wasn't a love. It was a true passion. But I've always enjoyed it. But Dad thought it was like I was wasting my money on a carnival ride. That's the way he looked at it.
Did you have any siblings?
I had a brother and a sister.
Did they have any interest in it?
No, they didn't have any interest in it at all. They came along later on. I was the first child, and they came along later on. So,
well, tell me about the house you grew up in.
It was on Austell Road. It was just a brick house located at the off the end of the runway at Dobbins on the western side out there. 612 Austell Road's where it was.
Was it sort of on its own or a part of a neighborhood or subdivision?
No, it was on its own on Austell Road there.
Okay.
It probably had about an acre of land with it.
Where did you start school?
I started in the city schools. I went to Keith Elementary School, the first and second grade. And during the second grade, my parents moved out to the county, out to Austell Road. Then I went to Robert L. Osborne Grammar School and High School. So,
okay, and then you said you started at Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it makes sense that you would have gone to Tech, but how was that just something you assumed you would do, or had you looked at other colleges?
No, that's the only place I wanted to go. I wanted to be an airline pilot. That's what my lifelong dream was always. Well, let me back up. I first wanted to go to Notre Dame College, and I'd gotten accepted, and my dad called me one day, and he said, "Son, there's no way that we can afford to send you to Notre Dame College. In fact, we can't afford to send you to any college, but you're an enterprising young man, and I'm sure you can figure it out. And by the way, I've got you a job." And he got me a job working for a pulpwood company cutting pulpwood. I didn't weigh much back then, about 140 pounds. Well, after about 3 weeks, I was down to 128. And I told my dad, I said, "You know, I think I can figure out a better way to get to college than this." And so that's when I got my job working here at the airport.
I see.
They just had opened the airport.
And tell me your age again when you came here for the first time.
Let's see, I was probably 16, 17 years old. I graduated early from high school. I think I was 16.
So, as I understand it, the groundbreaking was 1960?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Yeah, it was either 59 or 60, right?
So you were coming in right as it was being constructed?
Oh, yeah.
Or what preceded the airport? What was here prior to that?
Well, this was just a cornfield prior to that. And at that time, you had a little 1,600-foot airstrip out off Austell Road. That's the one I was telling you about where I flew out of a lot. And then George Montgomery had a little airstrip associated with his farm over here off the eastern end of the airport. Then you had Dobbins Air Force Base. And then you had a little airport out in the east part of the county called Park Air Airport. And that was owned by a guy by the name of Walter Nix. He and his wife, Walter and Kitty Nix, owned that airport.
Okay.
And so But I hung around as a young boy at that airport down off Austell Road. And there was a guy down there teaching me to skywrite and teaching me to tow a banner right after I got my commercial license. Well, they had just built Lake Altoona. And I was flying over the lake one time on a Sunday afternoon. There's a lot of cars down there. So I turned the smoke unit on that airplane and put it in a spin and spun it right to the ground and then recovered. And I caused an automobile accident. Not a serious one, but somebody got the number off the airplane. When I got back to the airport, I had a call from the FAA telling me to report to the Gato office down at Fulton County Airport, General Aviation District office down at Fulton County Airport. So I'll never forget, as long as I live, I was shaking in my boots. I walked in there and I met this guy. His name was Mr. Smith, same as the other guy. And he took one look at me and he said, "Son, how old are you?" And I said, "I'm 18. He said, "Do you plan on making a career out of aviation?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I'm going to do something I've never done. I'm going to let you off the hook on this. But if you ever do anything like that again, I'll see you never step another foot in an airplane." That was the last FAR I ever violated. You know, that made a believer out of me, you know. But it was a different time then. Now they'd bust you and take your license and everything else for that.
I was going to say.
But not back then. It was a totally different world.
Well, tell me about the development of this airport, how that came to be and who was involved.
Okay, a fellow by the name of Joe Sandman, who actually became a second father to me. Joe was in the Air Force out here based at Dobbins. And he married a lady named Joanne her maiden name was, it'll come to me in a minute. Her brother, her last name was Hames, Joanne Hames. Her brother was Luther Hames, who was the first full-time sitting judge, Superior Court judge in Cobb. Luther had toured the old northern district courts. He would go from city to city to city trying cases. And then when Cobb got to be big enough to have its own judge, he was the first sitting judge we had. Well, his sister was Joanne Hames, and Joe in the Air Force out here married Joanne. And Joe, flying in the Air Force and all, he flew P-51s during the Korean War, and he realized that this community needed an airport. So he went to work on it and managed to get all of the money, not all, most of the funding from the airport out of the Aviation Trust Fund. And I've got the letters and all back and forth to Washington and what all they did to get it approved.
Okay.
And he's the one who really put it together. And then when I started working here, he and I became lifelong friends. I mean, just forever vacation together, the families and all that kind of stuff. And he was like a second father to me. He really was. But he was one who'd keep me on the study path, you know, while I was in school. You know,
right.
If you hadn't done this and you hadn't done that, you need to work on this, work on that. But that's what I mean. I couldn't have gone to college at this airport and the people that were here.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow, he got it started and got it built. You've seen pictures of the opening ceremonies. It was a big deal when this airport opened. And I've always had tremendous pride in the county. I mean, I was just a little guy. When I was young, I'd introduce myself sometimes. I'd say, "My name's Larry Thompson. I'm from Cobb County, and we just got a new traffic light." Or, "We just got a new water tank." Because, you know, just a sense of pride. Well, when this airport was built, that was really something to brag about. You know, we just got a new airport, you know. And I've always been that way. But except for the time I was in the military, I don't believe I missed a single day coming to this airport for something or the other, you know, except when I'm traveling or something like that. So, but it's always been a huge part of my life. And I think that's why they gave me the records.
Because you were so connected with it from such a young age.
Yeah, from the very get-go.
And you said you were about 16, so really that's, what, 58?
It was, I was born in 42. I came here probably 18 when I started here because it opened in 60, if my memory serves me correct. They started building it, I think, in 19, latter part of 58 or 59, somewhere along in there.
And for the original construction, what was here?
There was a cornfield. It was just a big cornfield here.
Okay.
And the reason they put it here, they had enough land to get the runway in, and it's oriented east and west. And most of the prevailing winds here are westerly, easterly or westerly.
Okay.
We get some out of the north or northeast, northwest, but very seldom. Mostly east and west winds here. So that's why it's oriented this way.
And how long was the landing strip originally?
Originally it was 4,000 feet with no overruns.
Okay, but it's now, what, 6,300?
Yeah, 6,300 including overruns. It's the largest runway now, the longest runway in the region except for Hartsville and Dobbins.
Okay.
It's longer than Fulton County, longer than Peachtree to Cab, so it's longest runway in the region.
And how many aircraft can it accommodate? Like, what's the biggest aircraft?
Oh, we get 737s in here, and I know FedEx was talking about opening operation here, an air operation here at night, which I wish they would to utilize, because that'd bring a lot of money to the county and to the airport. I know I'd heard they offered the county $30 million to rebuild the road system around it so they could start using it at night. And I think they're just going to put conveyors over this road to get their packages into their distribution center over here. So I don't know what became of that. When I had the FBO here, I was working with them to, you know, to get that done, because I wanted to get the fuel contract with them while I had the fixed-based operation here. So
what's the FBO?
A fixed-based operation. It's just a, it's like a service station for airplanes. You provide hangar space, fuel, maintenance facilities, all that kind of thing.
So. And today, what is the predominant traffic through here?
I would say the predominant traffic, there's a couple of flight schools located here, so we have a good deal of flight training, but the vast majority of it is corporate. And the reason it's such a great location for corporate, the surface transportation, somebody landing here typically is going against traffic to go to, you know, areas down closer to Atlanta and what have you. Typically they're going against traffic. And two, the air route system, the arrival routes coming into Hartsville, they have gates, not the kind of gates you'd have at the airport, but they have arrival gates that they send most airplanes through that are going to Hartsville or wherever. You got one up here at Rome to the northwest, you got one up at Toccoa to the northeast, there's one down at Dublin to the southeast, and there's one down around Columbus down in there to the southwest. And all airplanes coming to this area from across country are fed through one of those arrival routes that go through those aerial gates. Well, when you look at this airport, it's so well located relative to those arrival gates, do you have very few delays. I've left Peachtree DeKalb Airport sometimes, particularly around 11 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you might get held on the ground over there for 30 or 40 minutes waiting for departure to pick you up because they have so much traffic during those time periods. Mm. But here, about the longest hold I've ever had has been like 2 minutes. You know, you just don't get it here. So corporate airplanes can get in and out of here real quick. And now then we've got customs down here, and you get people leaving here going to all over the world. I mean, literally all over the world from here. And so it's turned into to quite a facility.
How many planes a day?
I'm not sure. You get that from the airport manager. I'm not sure how many, you know, operations per day they have.
Okay.
But they keep track of it from the tower over there, so you can get that from him.
And that tower is a recent build, right?
Yeah, we didn't have a tower for a long time, and we didn't have an instrument approach procedure. Back in the day, when the weather was low, to get in here, you would fly what they call a GCA approach into Dobbins, a ground control approach. Then once you got below the ceiling, you'd follow the four-lane highway up here. We call it the four-lane. Y'all call it Cobb Parkway. It's always been the four-lane to us. But you'd follow the four-lane highway up here till you got to the airport, and you'd land. That's how you get in here when the weather was bad.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure all that was really that legal, but that's how everybody would do it back in the day, you know. Then we finally got the instrument approaches. And there used to be an intersection out here on the approach called Birdie, B-I-R-D-Y, which came from a dog that hung around here all the time. The dog's name was Birdie. Hung around here for years. And just a pet at the airport, so they named that intersection out there Birdie Intersection.
So when it was originally built in 1960, what was here after the opening day? What buildings?
Okay, there was only one building here. It was the administration building over there, and Joe found an old house somewhere, and they moved the house in here, and that became the administration building. That was the only building in here. The first hangar had not been built at the time. There were no hangars at the time, and that's another interesting story. The county never got the money to build that hangar over there. And so when they finally got it, I was working on the line. The guy that started running the maintenance section over there was a guy named John Gross. And I ran around with his son, John Jr. Well, he and I had built a little porch jet engine. We had it on a bicycle. And we were trying to close the back of it up to get more thrust out of it. We're in the corner of that hangar that the county built, and it blew up. It just popped, and I think blew sky high. Well, it blew the whole corner of that hangar out over there. And so I had to go see Herbert McCullum, you know, county. He was the last long commissioner, and he wanted to know what had happened and how all that had happened. And I was telling him, the whole time I was telling him about what was going on, he would lean back in his chair with his eyes rolled back, and I could just see him. I'm sending this kid down to the county farm. I could see it in his eyes, you know. And then finally he said, Larry, why in the hell did you blow my hanger up? Well, I never got the money for it. So he said, well, you got one or two choices. You can go spend some time down at the county farm, or you're going to rebuild that hanger back. And so I built the hanger back, and I tell everybody, that's kind of how I got in the construction business, because it wasn't just that damn hard, and the pay was good. So that's kind of how I wound up in the construction business. But when I was telling him, I could see his eyes roll back in his head, thinking, what an idiot.
Well, I know the field is named for him,
yeah,
right? Uh-huh. And how did that come about? What was his connection?
He was the last single commission chairman we had, and they named it after him. And
He have any involvement beyond being the loan commissioner?
Yeah, he helped. He helped Joe get it all done and get it approved through the county and all that kind of stuff. Some of those pictures I've got of the groundbreaking ceremony are him, you know, doing the groundbreaking ceremony. And he looked just like Lyndon Johnson, who was president. And everybody thought he was Lyndon Johnson. He looked just like him. But Herbert was, and I tell you, I won't mention any names, but Herbert was an expert poker player, one of the best poker players in the Southeast. And when they went to build Southern Tech, it got to be a big, every community in Georgia wanted that college. And so it came down to three counties. And so Georgia had an old research boat, they called it a research boat, down at Brunswick, or down at Savannah. So they got all three of them out on that boat, and they were going to negotiate, decide who was going to get the college. So finally, they decided they'd just cut a deck of cards. So Herbert cut the ace of spades out of that card. And everybody knew he was a good poker player. So they all got mad, almost got in a fight, and claimed he had somehow stacked the deck. Also, he didn't touch the deck. And they threw the cards out in the water, all that kind of stuff. So the boat captain got another deck of cards, and he said, I will shuffle the cards. Nobody touches them. And so they cut the cards again, and Herbert cut the ace of diamonds out the second time. So that's how Southern Tech got here. Oh. A lot of people don't know that story. Maybe I shouldn't tell all that. But I used to have lunch. I'd have lunch with Herbert, Luther Hames, the Superior Court Judge, Joe Sandman, and I would have lunch at Los Reyes Mexican restaurant every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And they would tell some of the doggone stories about Cobb. And I told them, I said, I want to record these stories because I'm going to write a book. I'm going to call it Politics and Grits. And Herbert and all of them said, no, when we're dead and gone, you write what you want to. But as long as we're alive, it stays at this table. But one day I'm going to write that book because it's hilarious. Some of the things they would tell you that went on in the old days were just absolutely hilarious.
I know, to get it just based on a poker game.
That's what it was, based on the gut of the cards.
Well, so in the early days, the county built it and owned it.
Yeah, they did.
But how long did that last?
The county still owns it, but they lease it to fixed-based operators. Like Hawthorne Aviation pays the county a rent fee, and they operate the airport.
Okay.
But the county owns the airport. It's like this hangar here. I pay them a ground lease per month, but I actually own the buildings. But I pay them a ground lease per month.
I see.
And that's the way that goes.
And in the early days, how did was it successful from the start financially?
Well, no, it was struggling, and I think that's why the county decided to lease it out to a individual, so the county didn't have to, because, you know, taking care of fuel and fuel receipts and all that kind of stuff, it was pretty awesome for a county government to be involved in a private enterprise like that. So they leased it to a guy named Cliff Pope, and the name of his company was Air Activities Incorporated, and that's who I went to work for, as the first line boy here, pumping gas and washing and waxing airplanes, and then later on became the first full-time flight instructor here. There was a part-time flight instructor here when I was there, a guy named Pete Eberhardt. And Pete and Mr. Pope had flown B-17s in World War II, and they had photographed every mission with an 8mm camera, and when the weather was bad, I'd sit and watch those films of those missions, and it is unbelievable. You'd see a formation of B-17s, hundreds of them, and you see German airplanes going in and out of that formation with P-51 Mustangs right behind them, just a big ball of airplanes. And every now and then they'd hit each other, you know, just a big ball of flame and all that kind of stuff. It's amazing to sit and watch that. It really was. But Pete gave me the instructions for my commercial pilot's license. And for your commercial, you had to demonstrate what's called Lazy Eight maneuvers and Shondells and all that kind of stuff. Well, Pete, being a World War II flight instructor, he taught me to do Lazy Eights and Shondells the way that they did back then. And in a Lazy Eight, you pick a point out on the horizon and you start doing maneuvers like this, and you want to, right as you're going past vertical, you want the nose of the airplane to go through that point. Then you start recovering going the other direction, and when the nose of the airplane goes through the point, right past vertical, you recover. And then a chandelle is a 180-degree turn maneuver. You pull up straight up, and as the airplane starts to go inverted, you start rolling like this and heading the other direction. Mm-hmm. Well, when I went to demonstrate it with the FAA, he said, let me see a lazy eight. So I said, I'll use that for a point, picked a point out there. And I started, and he said, stop right there. He said, let me see you do a chandelle. So I picked a point, started that. He said, Pete Everhart was your instructor. He's the one who signed you off, wasn't he? And I said, yeah. He said, we don't do them this way anymore. That's the way they did them in World War II. Here's how we do it. It's just a gentle climbing turn. He said, but if you can do those, we can do what we want. So don't worry about it anymore. Yeah. But I've told him a dozen times not to teach it that way. So.
Well, tell me about Cliff Pope. What was his, I mean, how long was he involved with the airport? What was his background?
He was involved for a very long time. I started working for him. Right straight out of high school, I mean, first job I had out of high school, you know, relative to airplanes, and I started working for him then, and I got married and had other jobs, and then finally went into the military, and Cliff passed away. No, I wasn't, I was out of the military when he passed away, because I was leaving. I had a little bonanza, and my wife and I were going to Florida, and when I took off, he talked to me on the radio when I was leaving, and I thought it was odd, because he rarely ever did that at all. But he passed away that weekend while we were gone. And he was, and I don't know how many years that was. That was probably, he was here 20 years, around 20 years, something like that. And then Bob Brown took over the FBO from him. And then we opened this one on the south side, you know, because all that was over on the north side. Nothing had been developed on the south side here. So we took over this FBO. Somebody else started it and it had bankrupted. And we bought it out of bankruptcy and put it all back together and got it going.
And may I ask, who was we?
My ex-son-in-law and myself, a guy named Mitch Nyman, put it together.
Okay.
And I.
That's connected in with your work, your non-flying work.
Yeah.
Which is?
I'm a real estate developer.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about the developments you've worked on and your general career outside of aviation?
Okay. Well, when I got out of the military, As I told you, I was offered a huge promotion. I was offered a promotion from first lieutenant straight to major with a promise to lieutenant colonel within a year if I didn't screw up. I would have been the youngest colonel in the United States Army if I had stayed. But I was afraid that one day I might have to push a button and kill a million people, and I didn't think I could do that. And in fact, I told my immediate commanders at the time I was in a position where I had to do that, and I told them, I said, if I get to write codes, I'm not sure I can do this. You need to know that. And this, I'll never forget this general, great officer, General Brown. He said, well, you're from the Atlanta area, aren't you? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, what if they dropped a nuclear weapon on Atlanta and it killed your family? And I said, well, nuke them till they glow and shoot them in the dark. And he said, you'll do. But anyhow, when I decided to get out, I decided I didn't want to blow things up and kill people. I'd rather build things. So I got out. My first business, I started building furniture out of whiskey barrels. And that lasted about a year. And that was like business 101. At the end of the year, I had made $32. That wasn't after I paid myself a salary. That was a total of $32. And so I decided I needed another line of work.
Yeah.
So I started building houses. And then I started developing real estate. I've developed about 10,000 lots in Cobb County and built about half that many houses. I did the first condominium development in Destin, Florida. And I did the first public shopping center in Georgia. We still own it at the corner of Sandy Plains and Shottleford Road. I still own that one. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot. I did the apartments over here behind Costco up on the hill over there at Shiloh Valley. I did those. It's just so much. It'd be hard to remember it all. I don't know how many subdivisions I've done. But they tell me I've done about 10,000 lots, residential lots in the county. I started as soon as I got out of the military. After I sold that barrel furniture company, I started in the building business, development business.
And how did your flying support that and improve that?
Okay.
Talk about the relationship between the two.
Okay. The best way to look at it, land to buy, is from the air, because you can tell. You learn a lot about population migration issues, which way it's headed, where to buy land, where not to buy land. And then, two, when I started developing shopping centers, you'll find that the people that negotiate leases for a company like Kmart or a company like Publix, they travel all over the country. They're traveling all the time negotiating these leases. And to get an appointment with them sometimes will take 6 months because they're just that busy. So what I would do, I would say, where are you headed? And I'd say, let me pick you up and I'll take you there and I want to negotiate the lease while we're on the way. And that's what I'd do. I'd sit and get another pilot, and I'd sit in the back and negotiate the lease with Publix and Kmart and all of them, you know, and it made it a lot simpler and a lot faster.
Right.
And then I got to know the people very well. I'll tell you a quick story about that. I go to simulator training every year. I'm required to by the FAA for recurrent training, and we do it in a simulator. I had been matched up with a guy. I had a King Air 200 at the time, and I'd been matched up with a guy named Charlie Jenkins several times. He just happened to show up at the same time I would show up. And in simulators training, they'll put you in as a crew, and you'll fly the left seat while the other guy's in the right seat, and then you'll switch. Well, I've been matched up with this guy named Charlie Jenkins, I don't know, half a dozen times. And he and I never discussed what we did professionally. We would fly the simulator together, study together, have dinner together, go out and get a drink together, and all that kind of stuff. We just never discussed what we were doing. And when I was doing this first shopping center for Publix, I wanted to make some architectural changes in it that they didn't want to agree to, or their engineers and architects didn't want to agree to them. But it was their first center in Atlanta, and we were sitting it down in the middle of a residential area, so I wanted to tone down all the commercial look and make it look a little more residential. Well, according to our agreement, Publix is going to cost Publix about $800,000, according to our agreement, to make those changes, and they didn't want to do it. So I said, well, I'm going to go see the boss. And I was going to see a guy named Charlie Jenkins. Never occurred to me the same guy. I walked into his office, and both of our mouths hit the floor. I said, Charlie, I don't know anything to do with Publix. And he said, well, my dad started Publix. And I said, you're kidding. He said, I didn't know you built shopping centers. And I said, yeah. And he said, we're going to open a bunch in Atlanta. I want you to do them all. Dumbest thing I ever said in my life. Well, Charlie, I'm getting older, and I don't work that hard. As dumb as you can be, because I'd have done every last one of them, you know, because we had that relationship going, you know. But aviation has done so much for me. It's been more valuable to me probably than any college degree, anything, because I flew Margaret Thatcher. I've flown Newt Gingrich several times. I flew Roy Barnes when he was campaigning all the way around. Let's see, who else? I flew Paul Newman. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, the governor of Texas, I can't call his name.
Abbott.
No, it wasn't Abbott, it's another one. He's going to run for president.
Rick Perry.
Yeah. And let's see who else. But anyhow, I get to meet all those people, and you interact with them. It's like Margaret Thatcher. I picked her up in Dallas and took her down to Houston to visit friends, and then we brought her back here for the prayer breakfast. Well, coming back here, I wanted to sit in the back and talk to her. And that was one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had in my life. She was an educator. She was a chemist, and she taught chemistry in school. So we talked about schools quite a bit. And she was talking about a high school shouldn't get over 1,000 students. Because she said, you, as a teacher, you can recognize everything in classes that size. If something's going the wrong way, you get it corrected real quick and all that kind of stuff. And I asked her, I said, how'd you get in politics? And she said, well, my father ran a little country store, and I would clerk in that store. And she said, all the men would come around and sit around a pot-bellied stove in the wintertime and talk politics. And she said, I just got interested in it. I just got so interested in it, so I got into politics. And I said, well, how did you wind up being the Prime Minister of England? And she said, well, I just kept going up and up and up. And she talked about when I took over 10 Downing Street, that's what she called it. When I took over 10 Downing Street, our tax rate was like 80%. And she said, when I left office, it was down around 20%. And she talked about socialism. She said, the real problem with socialism is, sooner or later, you run out of everybody else's money. And I thought, how true that is, you know. But it was so interesting. And another thing about her, she drank famous grouse. Maybe I'm talking out of school. I hope not.
Oh,
but she drank famous grouse scotch. But she wanted it in the little airline-style bottles. And I like to never found this stuff. So I finally had to buy a whole case of it to get it. She'd drink that stuff like water. I mean, so I still got most of that case around here somewhere. But anyhow, coming back, I had one of the other pilots up front, and she said to me, she said, well, Mr. Thompson, if your flight duties are over, would you have a drink with us? And I said, well, I've got a Budweiser up here. I'd like to have that if you don't mind. And she said, I don't mind as long as you have more than one. And so I said, my kind of woman, you know. So I got where I really liked her. But I asked her, I said, during the Gulf War, how did our President Bush did? And I've never heard this put this way. She said, oh, he really got wobbly on me. That's what she said. He really got wobbly on me.
Ooh.
But it was neat to sit there and talk to somebody like that. And then I saw her down in the Bahamas later. I've got a boat, and we were down at Nassau, and I had the boat in the marina. And I was walking up to the hotel there at the Atlantis Resort, and she was there with a whole scat of people around her. And so I didn't want to interrupt, so I didn't say anything. She walked over and said, "Mr. Thompson, you're not going to speak." And I said, "Well, Lady Thatcher, you were so busy, I didn't want to interrupt." "Oh, no, you come on over here, you know." But what I loved about it, while we were flying her, we would go in and all these dignitaries were just clawing at each other to get time with her, you know, and get pictures and all that kind of stuff. Well, she was spending all of her quality time with the people that were helping her, the line boys that were helping with the airplane and helping her with her baggage and all that kind of stuff, you know. And she had two briefcases she wouldn't let anybody carry except her. One of them had her speeches in, and her other had her jewelry and her makeup in. And when we landed, she said, "Mr. Thompson, can you get them to come close to the hangar when we get to the tarmac?" And I said, "Well, sure I can." And she said, "It's the how, you know."
But, well, I guess my question is, how would you get lined up to do that? I know she was at this prayer breakfast, which was a part of, what was that connected
it's
to?
Cobb County's annual prayer breakfast.
How was she invited to that, and then how were you contracted to fly her?
The committee that put it together decided one year they were going to try to get her as a keynote speaker, and she agreed to do it. But part of the agreement was they had to provide transportation for her. She was coming to this country anyway to visit people. And she would only, at the time, would only fly in Dassault Falcon-made airplanes, mainly because the systems on them are so redundant. They like quadruple redundancy on everything in that airplane. Mm. And so they're very safe airplanes. And so her security people only wanted her flying private airplanes, flying those Falcon airplanes. And I happened to have one. Well, Bob Hightower, a friend of mine, was on the committee. And he called me and he said, "We've got Lady Thatcher's agreed to be our keynote speaker, but we have to provide transportation from her, and she wants only to fly in a Falcon. Would you consider taking her?" And I said, "You're doggone right, I will." So that was one of the most enjoyable trips I've ever had in my life.
And tell me where you picked her up originally.
Picked her up at Dallas Love Field.
Oh, yeah.
And then I took her down to Houston's Hobby Airport. She was visiting a friend who was in a Methodist hospital down there, and she wanted to visit with him before we came here. And then we came here that night. And she wanted Newt Gingrich to introduce her. And so Newt was in Chicago, so after we dropped her off, we went to Chicago to pick Newt up. And I didn't go on that trip. The other pilots went, and my son went. But it was some of the worst weather you ever saw in your life. There was a line of thunderstorms. They were held in Chicago. Chicago's Midway, I believe, is where they were. And they held them for departures because of that thunderstorm. And there was a line that went all the way down across the country. And my son was telling me they were flying down that line trying to find a place to get through it, and they flew all the way down to Jackson, Mississippi before they could get around the southern end of it to come to Atlanta. Mm. And at one point, they called a controller and asked him if they could get a block altitude because the weather was so rough, it just up and down. And the controller said, "You're the only ones out there. You can have any altitude you want." So they had to land at Jackson, Mississippi to refuel to get back here to Atlanta. And I didn't go on that trip, but my son said it was a harrowing trip. But I'd flown him quite a bit.
Was 99?
Yeah, whenever, I can't remember the
year. So he would have not been Speaker.
He was Speaker of the House.
He was Speaker of the House at that time.
And I also served on the West Point Committee that would interview prospective applicants to the military academies, and I chaired the West Point Committee. So I really enjoyed that. That renewed my faith in young people. I interviewed a young guy I'll never forget him as long as I live, named Graham White. Graduated from high school with a 4.0 average, captain of the football team, the baseball team, the basketball team. His school did not have an ROTC organization, his high school, so he formed it, found his colonel to command it, set the whole thing up. He set up a repelling team that would demonstrate repelling procedures to military people in the Southeast. And when I interviewed him, I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, most young people have some hero or some mentor that they'd like to be like." And I said, "Do you have one of those? And if so, who is it?" And he named off one of Napoleon's generals. And I recognized the name, and I just couldn't remember it. And I said, "Well, why him?" And he said, "Well, he is the one who kept advising Napoleon not to continue into Russia, which beat Napoleon." And he said, "I've studied his strategy and everything, and I think he's a great, and that's who I wanted to model myself." And so I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, if you go to West Point and you get your commission, you have to branch. You've either got to be infantry, artillery, signal, or whatever. Have you thought about that?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to command the 82nd Airborne Division." And by golly, he did. Wow. He wound up commanding it. Neatest guy I ever saw. And Newt didn't have that many appointments that year. In fact, he was already full. You know, they have only so many they can appoint. And I told him, I said, "Newt, somehow, some way, we got to get this kid in. Because, I mean, he is a bolt of lightning for the military." And I happen to know the guy that chaired the West Point Committee in the district south of us. and Inner City was involved in that, and they didn't get a lot of qualified applicants. And his name was Pete. Oh, I can't call his last name. He's an attorney. Anyhow, I called him and I said, Pete, I got a kid we really got to get in this year. Do you have an extra opening with that congressman down there so we can get him in? He said, yeah, I got two. And so I told him about Graham, and I said, we need to get this kid in. So that's how we got him in. So, but I've always been well pleased with that. So.
Well, tell me about Dr. King and flying him.
Okay, the man I worked for, Mr. Pope, during the Civil Rights Movement, made his airplanes available to people involved in the Civil Rights Movement when they had to have emergency transportation. Normally they'd travel by bus or train or whatever, or to drive. But when they had to get someplace fast, he would make the airplanes available, and I would volunteer for those trips. And so I flew Dr. King on three different occasions. I took him to Memphis once, Birmingham once, and Washington once. And he was the most remarkable man I've ever met in my life. He'd sit up in front of the airplane with me, and I talked to him about things. Some of the things he said to me, it just shook me to the core. I asked him one time, I said, Dr. King, aren't you afraid of all the crazy stuff that's going on? Don't you fear for your life? Aren't you afraid? And he looked at me like I'd insulted him, and he said, Larry, a man that's afraid to die for what he truly believes in is not fit to live. And I've always remembered that. And then he went on to say, like I say, he wasn't afraid of dying. He went on to say, besides, when I die, I know where I'm going. Do you? And that really started me down my road to salvation. But I was a stubborn sinner. It took me a long time. And then he went on to say, Larry, and I told him, I'd flown some people when they're getting ready for that march in Selma over there. We were supposed to go over in the morning, come back late that afternoon, but we had to spend the night. And I went to pre-flight the airplane the next morning for our return trip to Atlanta, and somebody had drained all the fuel out of it and filled the tanks up with water. And I caught it on the pre-flight. And so I got after that, when I was flying one of those, I wouldn't leave the airplane. I would sleep in it if we were overnight, and I'd put a piece of string around the fuel caps, a little gem clip around the engine nacelle, so I'd know if somebody had tampered with it or messed with it or anything like that. And I related to Dr. King when I asked him that. I said, well, Dr. King, I'm a little bit scared because things that are going on, you know. He said, Larry, you don't have to worry about that. I know how to get you into heaven. He said, if something happens, I can guarantee I can get you into heaven. I know how to do it. And I said, well, that's reassuring, but I'm not quite ready to go yet because I'm still kind of like that sinning, you know.
So, were there other people that would fly along with you, or was it generally the two of you? How did that work?
Generally just be two of us.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so would he then, you know, disembark and meet somebody, a car would be waiting?
Yeah, a car would be waiting on him. And when I took him to Washington, we went into Washington National, which you could do back then. Now you can't. You got to have a TSA person with you to go into Washington National.
Yeah.
But Washington National is located right downtown, you know. And that's where I took him. And he was going to see President Johnson about trying to get the votes together for the Civil Rights Movement,
yeah,
to get that legislation passed. And he asked me if I wanted to go with him. And I regretted a million times I didn't go, because I would have got to meet President Johnson and all that kind of stuff. You know, I regretted a million times. But I was afraid to leave that airplane unattended. I really was, after that episode over there in Alabama.
Well, I got to ask you, what do you think it was about Cliff Pope and yourself at the time? Because I know a lot of people would not have been open to providing that kind of transportation.
Cliff was just a very fine man. I mean, he was just a genuinely good man. There was no evil in him at all. He was just a genuinely good man. And he had had some harrowing experiences in World War II, and he knew some of the pilots that were part of what they call that Red Tail Squadron,
the Tuskegee
Airmen. Yeah. He knew some of them, and I suspect that's where it came from. But at the time, like I said, I was not involved in the Civil Rights Movement. I was raised in a very prejudicial environment. But you couldn't be around Dr. King without getting involved in it. I mean, you just couldn't. And I tell everybody, I've given several speeches about that, and I tell everybody I was blind before I met Dr. King, and he gave me vision. But more importantly, I learned from him how to see through the eyes of my soul. And I was deaf before I met him, and I learned from him how to listen with my heart to the agony that my fellow man was suffering at that time. So it changed my outlook on a lot of things. I mean, a lot of things, being around him. He was the most remarkable man I ever met in my life, and the most courageous man I ever met. I met some very courageous people in the military, but their courage was usually an instantaneous reaction to some sort of life-threatening situation. I didn't have time to think about it. But Dr. King was different. His courage was a lot different. John Wayne once described courage as being scared to death but saddling up anyway. And I tell everybody Dr. King saddled up every day of his adult life. And like I say, he wasn't afraid of dying. I think he was a little bit afraid of the way he might die, but he wasn't afraid of dying. And then when he was killed in Memphis, I was in the military, and I have always felt that that was a conspiracy. I don't think it was just James Earl Ray, because James Earl Ray had escaped from a prison, if I'm not mistaken, up in Missouri, and was living in a boarding house here in Atlanta. And how would he know where Dr. King was going to be? Anyhow, he went to Memphis and rented a room in a boarding house there that had a restroom, a communal restroom, that overlooked the Lorraine Motel. And how would he know, escaped prisoner, how would he know where Dr. King was going to be? How would he know where to go? How would he know there'd be a bathroom overlooking the Lorraine Motel? Then he was picked up in Europe. When they picked him up, how could an escaped prisoner get a passport, get the money to go to Europe, all that kind of stuff? There's more involved. I've always felt that there's a lot more involved than what everybody said. And when I served on the Atlanta Regional Commission, Andy Young was mayor of Atlanta, so I got to know him fairly well. And I didn't ask him this. I didn't want to at the time, but Roy Barnes had asked him what really happened the day Dr. King was killed, and Roy related this to me, third person. But Dr. King, it was in early April. It was still cold. They had a function they were going to that night, but they were going to have dinner with another minister there in Memphis. And Andy Young had gone ahead to get the car. Well, it was cold. And so Andy had hollered back for Dr. King to bring his jacket. Well, Dr. King was standing on the balcony talking to some people down. He was on a second floor balcony talking to some people in the parking lot. I believe they were from the Southern Leadership SCLC.
Right.
I believe that's who they were from. And Andy was going to get the car, and about that time the shot rang out, and Andy ran back as hard as he could go. And he said, I ran up the steps, and he said, I knew Dr. King was gone as soon as I saw him. The bullet struck him in the neck and kind of in the face and severed his spinal column. He said he was still alive at the time, but he had died, you know, just shortly thereafter. But I've always felt that there was more to that than just a simple assassination. I really did. But like I say, Dr. King was the bravest man I've ever met in my life. I mean, really, he was unbelievable and had a true sense of humor. I mean, he was one time I was at a gathering, he was giving a speech, and he'd gone to Birmingham. They had a strike ongoing with sanitation workers over there, and he had gone over to help them in that strike. Well, they had a guy that headed up the public services over there. His name was Bull Connor. I think it was Gene Connor. Eugene Connor might have been his name. I don't remember. But they called him Bull Connor. And Dr. King and him prevailed when he got back. He was addressing some folks, and he said, you know, we managed to win out over there in Birmingham, and we converted old Bull Connor into a steer. And I always thought that was funny as hell. But he had a keen sense of humor about stuff like that, you know. Yeah. But I really grew to like him. I really did.
That's incredible. Wow.
It was.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the airport here.
Okay.
If you don't mind. And
can I go to the restroom?
Of course, please.
Okay, excuse me.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about some very basic questions about flying and the role of air traffic controllers, that kind of thing. At this airport in particular, what are the sort of permanent staff positions on a daily basis?
Here?
Right.
Well, with the county, you've got an airport manager and an assistant airport manager, and they pretty much oversee the operations of the airport as it relates to the county. But then you've got tower personnel. It's a private tower, and the county pays for it. It's not a federally operated tower. It's what's called a private operated tower. You see a lot of that. The county pays for it. And then you've got Hawthorne Aviation, and I don't know how many people they employ. And we employed, I think, like 20 or so people when we had the fixed-based operation here. But the employment goes way beyond that, the jobs it creates and all that sort of thing. Because this is a corporation wanting to locate here, this is our front door. This is the first thing they see when they come to Cobb County. And I know in years past, I was on the board of directors of Chamber of Commerce. The Rolls-Royce Corporation was wanting to open a jet engine
plant here in Cobb associated with Dobbins. And I spent a couple of days with the CEO of Rolls-Royce and his wife looking at housing. And they decided not to come here because housing was too expensive. Then Mercedes-Benz assembly plant that went to Alabama, they looked here as well, and they didn't come here because of the same reason, was housing for the employees. But the first thing somebody sees of Cobb County, a corporation thinking about investing here, first thing they see is this airport right here. So that's why I'd always fuss at the county manager and the airport manager about keeping the grass cut and making it look like something. And you can see all the landscape and stuff around it. It doesn't look like the typical airport. So you get a better feel about it when it looks like that. There's an airport out in California, prettiest airport I've ever seen, called the Nutmeg Airport. Really a pretty little airport. They got flowers out there, you know, wildflowers, really pretty.
Yeah.
But airports don't have to look like airports, you know.
Well, I guess my question is that you mentioned taking the Rolls-Royce executive around. How do you get looped into those?
Well, I was on the board of directors, Chamber of Commerce, okay. And they were coming looking, and so
you can fly, and so
yeah,
why not?
Yeah, it just kind of, I was involved in aviation and also in construction development and all that kind of stuff, and they're all interested in housing costs for their employees, you know, and travel times and all that kind of stuff. Transportation, schools, they get interested in all that. And Cobb has always been the best business county in Metro Atlanta up until just recently. I don't want to go get into that, but up until just recently, it's been the very best business county in all of Metro Atlanta. We had the lowest taxes, highest level of services. Just everything Cobb had going for it. And so a lot of people are interested in Cobb. Mm-hmm. And then too, for a major corporation, your utility costs are relatively low here because it doesn't get that cold in the winter, doesn't get that hot in the summer. A lot of people disagree with that, but for a major corporation, you know, it's not like being up in New York or Chicago where it's snowing all the time and all that kind of stuff. So it's a good place to put a company, particularly manufacturing operations. And
go ahead.
But anyhow, Hewlett-Packard was here, and Hewlett-Packard is one of the very best corporate partners a community can have. But we had one commissioner back then whose name will remain anonymous. I didn't think too much of him. But he literally ran Hewlett-Packard off, and all Hewlett-Packard wanted to do was build a multi-level parking lot for the employees. And this guy was insisting that they carpool. And so Hewlett-Packard said, hell with you. So they just moved across into Fulton County, which was terrible, you know, it was awful.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, well, I shouldn't get into all that because I start mentioning some names, but I know there's a big deal to try to keep them here, and the guy that was hosting the deal to keep them here, he had everybody who's who in Cobb County and most of Georgia trying to keep him in Cobb, and yet he was the one who caused them to leave. one of the key people that caused them to leave to begin with. But
for the aircraft that you've piloted, you mentioned owning many planes over the years.
I have.
How many do you own at this time?
We've got two. Well, I own one. My son owns one.
And for flying into this airport, I know some of these questions may seem off the wall, but you know, what's the biggest plane you've brought in here?
The biggest would probably be, fastest or biggest. I fly this.
However you measure.
Okay, well, I fly this old Falcon jet, which it's 8 passengers and 2 crew. So, and that's what I fly now, mostly all the time. I use that in my business and part pleasure and part business.
How often are you flying?
The past year, I hadn't been doing that much. We had a big inspection. The airplanes have to be inspected on certain intervals, you know. We have 6-month inspection, yearly inspections. Well, there's one inspection that comes every 12 years, and it's the big one. We literally take the airplane apart, check everything on it. And so we had that one this year, and it took 8 or 9 months to do it, so we just hadn't flown that much this past year. Typically, I will fly anywhere from 150 to 200 hours a year. And not so much as I used to because I'm not negotiating leases or anything like that anymore. I'm kind of semi-retired, so I don't fly nearly as much as I used to.
Is that for vacation?
Yeah, we use it to travel, for personal travel. And then I do a lot of bono work. If somebody's ill and got to get to a hospital or something like that, we volunteer a lot of that. So
I see. Talk to me a little bit about Aviation Park. You know about the park?
Yeah,
here.
I do.
What was your involvement with that?
Well, they asked me to speak at the opening thing, and I think it's a great thing. Here's why I think that. I have seen so many young people headed the wrong direction, and they discover flying. And flying is a narcotic. I mean, if you love it, it's passionate with you, and you can't stop. And you can't drink alcohol, and you can't take narcotics, and you can't do all of those things and maintain a pilot's license. The FAA will take it from you just in a second. And when you go for a medical, your medical certificate now, you're checked for all of that. And you have to sign an affidavit that you have not had a DUI within the past 2 years or whatever, you know. And you have to give them permission to check your traffic, your you know, driver records and all that kind of stuff. So when young people get interested in it, they wouldn't dare do anything that would mess that up. I know one guy that was headed the absolute wrong direction. I won't call his name, but he had dropped out of high school, was really headed the wrong way. He discovered flying, got back, got his high school diploma, went to Auburn University, majored in aviation management, got on flying for Delta, and now is Delta's lead simulator instructor, one of the best pilots I ever saw in my life. But flying completely turned him around, and I've seen it a half a dozen times. I have people come to me and say, boy, I'm having trouble with my son, or my daughter's doing this, my son's doing that. And I say, give him a couple of flying lessons and see what happens. And usually, they'll take to it. It's a tremendous confidence builder, and it teaches you success mechanisms, because you have to master one discipline before you can move to the next. You have to master those two before you can move to the third, and so on. Well, those are success mechanisms. I use that stuff in my business every day. You learn to use checklists in a business. You check everything off, make sure everything's done. It's the same thing, you know. So I encourage people to use aviation. And that park over there will get young people interested in aviation, or it should. I expect it to. And there's no telling. You never know how far-reaching that's going to go. You never know. But I can remember as a kid over there, Larry Bell Park, they had an old B-29 sitting out there, and we'd all play in that thing all the time, you know, and imagine flying it like little kids, you know. And it just, it really creates a direction, a purpose, and keeps you kind of down the straight and narrow. We'll get you to study when you ought not, I mean, we don't want to study, you know, because right. You got an objective to reach. So I think the park is going to change a lot of young people's lives. And so
are there any particular stories about this airport that you haven't shared but you would want to see included or preserved in an exhibit there?
I'd have to think about that one a little bit. I would really like to see Kennesaw College start an aviation program. I really would. There's such an acute shortage of pilots now. Corporations are parking their jets because they don't have anybody to fly them. Delta is now recruiting people out of Auburn's flight training school, and Delta's put up money for that school, and they're recruiting directly out of that school. Well, Cobb County is an aviation community, and it always has been. And you got this airport sitting right next to that college. I mean, it's such a natural thing. I would love to see Kennesaw University start a flight school and flight department, flight program, mm-hmm. aviation management, aeronautical engineering, the whole nine works. The whole nine yards, because it's Cobb County's an aviation community. It really is.
Well, can you tell me about your family, your wife and children?
I have two children and four grandchildren. My two children, Amy, she majored in aerospace engineering at Auburn, and she flies as well. However, she's in the she buys houses and fixes them up and sells them. She's in kind of the, you know, development and construction business herself. And then my son Josh, he works with me every day. And Josh is qualified. He's type certificate in the jet, and then that other airplane out there belongs to him. So all of us fly, and then my wife has taken what they call pinch hitter courses. If I'm flying by myself, something happens to me, she trained enough to get the airplane back on the ground without killing herself. So, but we've all been involved in it.
May I ask her name?
Mary. And best thing I ever did was marry that woman. I make no mistake about it.
When did y'all marry?
1964.
Okay, so you married her just before you entered the military.
Yeah, what happened to me, I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. Show you how powerful those politicians were back then. Joe took me down to see Herbert McCollum in the old courthouse building, that old rickety courthouse building we had down there for years. Mm-hmm. And I went to see Herbert, and Joe took me in there, and he said, Herbert, Larry works up at your airport. He wants to go to the Air Force Academy. Herbert picked the telephone up, and he called Eugene Talmadge, Senator. I don't know if you ever heard of Talmadge.
Oh, yeah.
An icon. So he was telling him, he said, humming, he said, I got a boy who works up here at my airport, wants to go to the Air Force Academy. And in a few minutes, he said, no, we ain't going to take no damn test. We just want the appointment. So the appointment came down. So, but I decided to get married instead. And you couldn't go to the Air Force Academy if you were married. So that's kind of how that went down. I was already in college at the time, but I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy.
Yeah. So you were in the military from 65 to 69.
Yep.
And you did not return to tech after that.
No, I didn't. I should have went back and finished, but I got started in my business, and it started being successful, and so I just got all caught up in it. And I should have studied civil engineering, because that's what I use every day.
Well, just to clarify with the military, we had talked about a few things before we started the interview, and I know that in your role, it was one of those positions that there were only five or six in the country at the
time. Yeah,
yeah. Tell me about that.
Okay. When I went in the military... I was getting on with United Airlines, and at the time that was a critical occupation because the Vietnam War was going on. And critical occupation, if you were an airline pilot, you were exempt from the draft. It was like being in college, you were exempt from draft while you're going to college. And if you were an airline pilot, you were also exempt because it was critical. Well, I wanted to fly for the airlines, and United Airlines started hiring when I was in the first quarter of my senior year. So I applied and basically was hired by United. And so I had timed everything. Well, let me back up a little bit. To be qualified for the draft deferred status, you had to be a line pilot with an airline. You couldn't be a pilot in training. You had to be a line pilot and have a route assignment and all that sort of thing. So I'd been hired by United, and I'd signed up for school the first quarter of my senior year at Tech, and I had everything timed. By the time I dropped out of school, I figured it'd take 3 to 4 weeks for them to catch up with me. And by then, I'd be in training and should be close to having a route assignment with United. So I dropped out of school to go to Denver to start that. Well, when I got there, they had delayed my class date by 2 weeks. And I liked 2 weeks having a route assignment with United when I got my draft notice. And I was miserable. I'll never forget. I had basic training down here at Fort Benning, and I was sitting on my bunk one morning, my head down about 4 o'clock in the morning, just crying the blues. And this old drill sergeant, they're meaner than hell anyway, he walked up and he put his arm around me, and he said very nicely, he said, "Son, what's wrong with you?" And I told him, and he said, "Well, son, around here you might as well be happy because nobody gives a damn if you're not. Now get your ass up and go." And they give you all these tests when you go in there. First of all, they gave me a test purely about flying. And I maxed that test. And so they called me in, and they said, "What'd you do in civilian life?" And I said, "Well, I was a flight instructor." And they said, "Well, we're needing flight instructors. Nobody's ever made 100 on this test. So we're prepared to offer you a warrant officer commission, and you'll go to Fort Rucker and flight instruct for 4 years. And I said, "Well, I've been doing that a long time. I got close to 4,000 hours of flight instruction. I don't want to do that anymore. I just want to serve my 2 years and go back to work for United." So he said, "That's fine." So anyhow, a couple of days later, after all the other tests, they called my name out one morning and told me to report to the mess hall. Well, I went to the mess hall, and this colonel was over there, and they had orange juice, cookies, and ice cream. And you don't get that in basic training. You just don't get that. Meat and potatoes is what you get in basic training. So this colonel says, "Private, you've qualified for officer candidate school. We're needing officers, and I've got the paperwork here for you to sign." And so he started explaining to me how much time it's only take me to get through OCS and how long I'd have to serve after OCS and all that kind of stuff. And I said, "Well, sir, I just want to serve my time and go back to United. I got a good job waiting on me, so I just want to serve my time and go on back." And he said, "Well, it's voluntary. You don't have to." And he turned around. His guy's name was Vernon. "Sergeant Vernon, take over." And so Sergeant Vernon gets on a bicycle, and I run all the way out to the rifle range with 12 miles out there and 12 miles back. And as soon as I get back, I go to the mess hall and start peeling potatoes for breakfast. When breakfast was over, I started scrubbing pots and pans. Then it was back out to the rifle range and back. Back to the mess hall to peel potatoes for the lunch meal. After lunch, wash pots and pans. Then back out to the rifle range and back. And that sergeant riding the bicycle, you know, me running. I lasted 2 days, and I told him, I said, "Sergeant Vernon, I kind of changed my mind about that OCS. I think that's a pretty good deal." So the next morning, I go to the mess hall again, got the cookies and ice cream and orange juice. So I sign up, and I go to the morning formation, and this drill instructor says, "I want all you privates to know that one day Private Thompson's going to be my boss, but today his ass is mine." And I jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. And I mean, but it was good for me. So I went to OCS, graduated top in my class. I graduated from OCS one morning at 11 o'clock. At 1 o'clock that afternoon, I took my first command. I was commander of a nuclear warhead, 85th USA Warhead Detachment. I was detached to the West German Air Force. I was trained then as a nuclear weapons tactics and deployment expert. My job would have been to advise an Army or theater level commander, if he had the authorization to release nuclear weapons, which weapon to use and how to use it. where you have an airburst, a surface burst, what size weapon, kiloton, what, you know, I could launch three weapons at the time, 1560 and a 200 kiloton weapon. To put that into perspective, the weapons that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one was 10 megatons, one was 15. You've seen that destruction. Can you imagine what a 200 kiloton weapon would do? I mean, it's just, mankind should never have discovered all of that. But anyhow, I was put in charge of that, and that unit was ultimately disbanded, so I wound up commanding a regular Pershing firing unit, and ultimately wound up commanding the service battery of that. And the service battery, when I was in garrison, I had like 600 people under my command, and when I go to the missile range, I'd pick up an infantry company, an ordnance company, a signal company, I'd pick up a medical detachment, several NASA civilians, and about 30 warrant officers. So I'd have about 1,200 people under my command when I was on the missile range. And I was first lieutenant, and I was holding down a full colonel slot. Well, when it came time for me to get out, I decided to get out because I wanted to go back to flying. And so General Brown, I met with him about it, and he offered me a promotion from first lieutenant straight to major with a promise to lieutenant colonel within a year if I didn't screw up. And I would have been the youngest colonel in the military, but I knew that weapon system inside and out. I'd been involved in some service testing on a new part of that system for acceptance in the military weapons inventory, and in fact had run a good portion of that service testing, and I had written most of the operations manuals, or had revised the operations manuals for that system. They have to be written so that a private E0, long-term read and write, understand the language, can read the manuals and fire that system and hit a target. So I'd written most of the ops manuals, or rewrote the ops manuals for that weapon system. So I knew it inside down, upside down, and backwards. Well, they offered me a promotion to major, promised the lieutenant colonel, and a $60,000 reenlistment bonus. And so I told them, I said, well, I'd like to take a week off to think about this. So I took a week off. I had a lot of leave coming to me. And so I took a week's leave, checking a hotel out there in Oklahoma, and tried to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And I ultimately decided I didn't want to push a button and kill 1 million people. And I was afraid I'd be faced with that at some point in my life. So my greatest joy I have is building things. I built airplanes, built houses, so I enjoy building. So I decided I'm just going to get out and go build something. And that basically, I know that's a very simple way of looking at it, but I didn't want to do that anymore. Mankind should never have discovered that. I mean, it really shouldn't have. And,
well, I know we're bouncing around a little bit and we're closing in on the finish. I just want to ask you a couple more things. You mentioned when you were quite young and you went through those pine trees.
Oh.
Have you been in other accidents?
No, I take that back. I was teaching a guy here, an old pilot. I won't call his name, but he had barnstormed when he was a young guy in an old Jenny. You know what barnstorming is?
Explain.
He would fly around and find an open pasture someplace near a city, and he would land. He'd fly over the city, and then he would land, and then start giving rides for $2 or $3 a piece, and they call that barnstorming. And he'd just land in a pasture somewhere. Well, he had done that as a young man in an old World War I airplane. Well, he had a globe swift, and he didn't know how to navigate. And the way he would navigate, he had a map of the Southern Railroad system, and he would fly down here to Inman's switching yard down here and pick out the railroad that would go on where he wanted to go, and he'd follow that railroad. Well, he left here one day, and I'd worked with him and worked with him. And he left here one day. Well, first of all, back then they had what they called flight watch. And I told him, I said, Bob, I want you to, whenever you fly, you ask for flight watch with the FAA when you file your flight plan. The reason I wanted him to do that, because he had to do flight planning or cross-country planning. And with flight watch, you had to estimate your time of arrival within 3 minutes. And if you didn't, and that meant you had to figure all the winds and all that kind of stuff, and that's what I wanted him to do. That's why I asked him to do it. Well, I heard him filing a flight plan one day, and he said, ETA? Well, that'll be Thursday or Friday sometime. And I said, Bob, we need some more lessons. Come here, buddy. So anyhow, I finally got him tuned up on that, and he left here one day going to the Masters Golf Tournament, which is east-southeast of here. He took off and flew due west as he could go and flew slam out of sight. And everybody thought he was down someplace. Looked for him for 2 weeks. And finally he showed back up, and I damn near kissed him because I was really worried. Not only was my name on his ticket, I really liked the old gentleman. You know, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, he shows back up, and I just damn near hugged him. I said, Bob, where in the hell have you been? Everybody in the world has been looking for you. And he said, Larry, it doesn't matter which way I go, that compass points east. And I said, well, Bob, they don't work that way. Does the fluid come out of it or something? He said, no, it just points east all the time. So I said, let me go look at it. So I went out there, and the compass was on top of the instrument panel, and he had hung his earphones over that compass. Well, the earphones got two magnets in them, and it had that compass locked in. I mean, you couldn't have moved it with a sledgehammer. And I took the earphones off, and it swung back around. He said, golly.
It's that simple.
Yeah. Can you believe that? And so he'd been facing, no matter which way I go, that compass points east. But anyhow, you asked me about an accident. I was teaching him one time, and he had palsy. He was flying on a waiver, and he'd sit there and shake while he's flying, you know. It's kind of eerie, but he's a pretty good pilot. But I was with him one day in that Swift, and the bridge up at Red Top Mountain, he starts headed for that bridge, screaming downhill at it. And I said, Bob, what are you fixing to do? He said, I'm going to loop that bridge. And I said, no, not with me in here. You're not going to loop that bridge. So anyhow, we came back to land, and he ground looped the airplane to the crosswind, and he ground looped it, and there were no brakes on the right side, so I couldn't get it recovered. Well, he ran off the runway up here, out here, and the dirt and dust flying up over the windshield and all this kind of stuff. It wiped the gear out of it. And he turned around to me. He was shaking. He said, boy, I ground looped the shit out of that. I said, yeah, Bob, he ground looped it pretty good.
What does it mean, ground loop?
It's a tailwheel airplane, and they spin around like that.
Okay.
You lose control of them. They get going sideways, and they'll spin around.
Well, and for the bridge, what did he mean he was going to loop the bridge?
He was going to fly under that bridge, do a loop over it, and come back and fly right back under it again. And I said, no, not me in here, Bob. We're not going to do that. Those days for me are past.
I forgot. I don't think we said this on the tape, but the Osborne High School story. Can you tell that again?
Yeah. That airplane I showed you, I bought it wrecked. A guy ground looped it down at the old dirt airport down there on Oxtail Road. And I walked up and I said, I'll give you $500 for it. He looked at the airplane. He looked at me and said, son, you just bought yourself an airplane. So I think I was 14 or 15 years old when I did that. So anyhow, I told him, I said, I'll need a little time to get the money up. I need at least 90 days. And he said, all right, I'll give you that. So I sold my horse, I sold my bicycle, anything I'd sell to get money. I picked up Coca-Cola bottles on the side of the road, selling them to get the money up, collecting newspapers and selling them. Finally got the money up and paid him. A couple of guys over at Lockheed helped me rebuild that airplane. And then my senior year in high school, toward the end of my junior year, I guess, I was 16. But anyhow, a buddy of mine said, let's go get that, play hooky today and go get that airplane fly around something. I said, that's a great idea, let's do it. So we skipped school. And we got going. They just built a new gymnasium at Osborne High School and had a flat roof on it. It only had three pipes sticking out of it, the vent pipes for the restroom and a pipe for the heater, and it was on one side of the building. So Ray, my buddy, says, let's go bounce this thing off that gym over there. And I said, that's a good idea. So we go over there and flew down, bounced it off the gym, went and did it three times. And the next morning I had to go see the principal. Well, the principal read me the Riot Act. He was talking about you could have killed yourself. We had to turn the whole school out. We thought the airplane was crashing, trying to get in the athletic field. And you could have tore the gym up, hurt yourself, killed other students. And he said, I'm going to give you 2 weeks out of school to think about what you've done. And so I tell everybody, little did I know, the man that was expelling me from Robert L. Hausman High School at the time would some 5 years later become my father-in-law. And then the rest of that story, Ray, my buddy, Ray was the original Fonzie, was always in trouble. Motorcycles and fighting and all that kind of stuff. Ray got a doctorate degree in molecular biology with a full professorship up at Wake Forest University.
Wow.
And he did extremely good research work on the AIDS virus. And he called me one day and he said, Larry, I figured AIDS out. He said, the AIDS virus attaches itself to a cell through a protein bond and it takes over the operation of that cell. And he said, I figured out how to break that bond. And now I'm working on how to kill that virus without killing everything else. And he came up, all kind of stuff. And my wife got multiple myeloma. And when he found out about it, he several months later, he called me and he said, Larry, has Mary ever had measles? And I said, I don't know why. And he said, well, I have discovered that the myeloma virus, I can kill it. I can infect a person with the measles virus. The measles virus will kill the myeloma virus, then I can cure the measles virus. But it won't work if she's ever had measles or had a measles shot.
Tell me, just real quick, the principal's name that was your father-in-law?
It was Philip Adelsheimer, Adelsheimer.
Okay.
And he's rather a character. I didn't know him, you know, until I got married, because he had to put the professional persona on in high school. But actually, he was quite a character. I mean, he really was. But
tell me, that picture of you paragliding.
Yes.
Tell me all about that.
Well, we got hold of an old parachute, and we got to looking at it, and myself and Cliff Pope's nephew that I worked for, and a guy named Don Cash, a friend of mine, we got a hold of this old parachute, and we got looking at it, and we thought, well, you know, if we cut a couple of gores out of that thing and hook it to a, you know, a power source back of a pickup truck, it'd probably lift us up. So I wanted to toss to try it the first time, and we just took a broomstick and cut it, stuck it through the shroud lines, and I just hold on to the broomstick, and we had it tied to the back of a pickup truck, and they'd take off hard as they could go. And you, about the point you start stumbling, getting drugged, that parachute will open up and lift you up. We get 50, 60 feet off the ground. And then when the truck is stopped, you just float down, you know. So,
it was a soft landing?
Yeah, to a soft landing, yeah. The takeoff was bad, but the landing was soft. but the newspaper wanted to get a picture of it, so come here and took a picture. That's what that is back there, you know. But at the time, I was engaged to my wife. And the people she worked with, she showed them that picture, and they said, are you going to marry this idiot? And so the best thing I ever did was marry her. So,
and when did y'all marry?
1964.
Okay, and I have two more questions. The next to last is, if you were going to explain to young people,
yes,
the most important elements of flying. So it's not the time management or the list, that kind of thing. It's more the aeronautics. What are the basics of flying? What do you need to master?
Well, boy, that's a hard question to answer. First, you got to like it. You see two kind of people. Some people like it. Ones that like it love it, and it'll ultimately become a passion. And then some people just don't like it, and it scares them, and they just don't want to have anything to do with it. So first of all, you got to like it. And then once you like it, it's like a narcotic. You get addicted to it. You can't stop. And like I said earlier, I've seen it turn so many young people around, it's unbelievable when they discover flying. But all the disciplines you have to know, it teaches success mechanisms. You have to know a lot about designs, aerodynamics. Hey, George, how you doing? But you have to know a lot about design, aerodynamics, principles of flight, lift, drag, you know, all that kind of stuff. What makes an airplane turn? Actually, the lift makes it turn. Just a lot of stuff, a lot of disciplines you have to learn. But in the process of learning all of that, that's where you learn the success mechanisms, because you got to master one discipline before you move on to the next and so on. And you use that everywhere. You use it in business. I use it in business all the time. Checklist you use all the time. But above all, you have to learn to be methodical. You train a certain way, you fly the way you train, and you go by checklist, and you don't leave anything out. Even if you've done it a million times, you know it by heart. You still go by that checklist, and you have to know what you're looking for. You know, the people have been known to be checking gas. They open a gas cap, looking at, yep, gas is checked. Won't be any gas in there, because they've done it so much. You know, so you have to know what you're looking for. So it's quite a process to learn to fly. It really is. But
and I mean, you were doing some of this stuff so young. That's what is interesting to me, putting together the basics at that age. I mean, were you referring to manuals, or was it just something you had a feel for at the time?
I had a feel for it. And then when I started building model airplanes, I learned a lot about aerodynamics. I started building a control line model that you hold, you know, with your hand. And when I first started building, the things would come back over on me, you know, and because you couldn't get up enough centrifugal force to keep the lines taut. So I finally realized that wing is what's lifting it, so I would just make the inside wing longer than the outside wing, and it'd give more lift, which would keep the cables tight that I could fly, you know. So I started doing that, and that's when I began to learn about aerodynamics, about lift and lift coefficients and you know, all the technical stuff. I'd read books about it, you know. I didn't understand it all, but I'd understand enough at that age to where I could, you know, incorporate it into what I was doing in that little airplane I built when I was in my teens, you know, damn near killed myself in. I had calculated the center of gravity on the airplane. Most airplanes balance around what's called 25% of Mach, the mean aerodynamic chord. And about 25% of that chord is where an airplane balances. And it's the center of lift. If you look at a wing, it's shaped, you know, like that. Well, the center of that high point on that wing is about where the center of lift is. And the way they work, the air has to go over that wing and under the wing at the same amount of time, but it goes further over the top surface than it does the bottom surface. Mm. So as a result, you're creating a low pressure area on top of the wing and a high pressure area on the bottom wing, and that's where the lift comes from. That's what makes them fly. But I learned a lot about that from building model airplanes. And then so when I got into real airplanes, it was just a You know, it was just natural. I worked at what was called a doping fabric shop for a little while. Well, the old airplanes, they covered them in fabric and Irish linen, and you put a paint on, basically a lacquer paint, but they called it aircraft dope, and it tightens that fabric up. Well, I'd worked in a doping fabric shop a lot, so I learned a lot about airplanes, and I know I would always test fly them. We recovered an Aeronautica Champion one time, and the aileron cables on that airplane come together right above the pilot, two turnbuckles. And if you get them reversed, when you put them together, the ailerons are reversed. And so I took off, and they were reversed. And the hardest thing in the world, if you want to turn left, you give it left stick, and it goes right. So you had to sit there and think for a minute. If I hadn't worked on it, I wouldn't know what was wrong. I'd probably crash the thing.
Yeah.
But it's really hard. If I want to make a left turn, put the stick to the right, you know, it's hard.
Get used to it.
But I got it back down, and we changed them around, and it was fine. But I learned a lot from all of that, you know. And then when I started studying aerodynamics in college, that's when it got really sophisticated, all the math that got involved in it. You know, you weren't just wanting guesswork. It was, you know, you could determine center of lift and all kind of stuff. You have force vectors on certain parts in there, you'd have to calculate. You know, teach you how to calculate how much force was on this, and then you study strength of materials. You know, get into the real technical aspect of it when I was in college. So it's a very difficult field to study, actually. It really is.
Yeah, it's completely Greek to me.
Yeah, it's a difficult field of study. To give you an example, I would go to Georgia State College, and I'm not running Georgia State now, two different institutions.
Sure.
But I'd go to Georgia State sometimes in the summer or at night to take the courses I had to have to graduate from Tech, like Georgia history and U.S. government. You had to have that stuff. Well, Tech's a numbers school. I mean, it's numbers. And so I'd go over there to take those classes. Well, when I transferred over there, they will accept anything from Tech, but Tech won't accept very much from them. But when I transferred over there, the girl says, after she looked at all, she said, well, you can just take a semester or two. You can get a degree in physics. You can get a degree in math. Just all you got to take is one quarter or one semester. And I said, well, I want to get it from Tech.
Yeah.
So I never did do it, you know. But Tech was a tough school for me. It really was. I thought I was stupid. I mean, I'd work my can off and just barely get by. You know, it was hard, really hard.
To finish up, are there people that you would recommend me reaching out to for more history of the airport? People who would, like you, have that connection to the early days of the airport?
Lord, I can't think of anybody right now. We need to go through this paperwork.
All right.
Now, Herbert McCollum gave a speech in here later on about the history of the airport, and there's a lot of stuff you can glean from that.
Okay.
Also, I've got the history of Dobbins, which is so interesting.
Excellent.
You need to look at Dobbins.
Okay, well, I appreciate it, Mr. Thompson, and we'll conclude there.
Okay.